This is the Pittsburgh Section National Council of Jewish Women, May 10th, 1988. Harold Kimball and Ann Fagan interviewing Dr. Jerome Rosenberg. Tape 1, Side 1. Dr. Rosenberg, please state your full name, your address, and your date of birth.
My name is Jerome L. Rosenberg. I'm usually called Jerry. My home... Pardon me.
This is the Pittsburgh Section National Council of Jewish
Women. Oh, you're doing it all over again.
Shall I not?
My residence is 1029 South Nugley Avenue. We've been living there for almost 34 years. And my date of birth is June 20, 1921.
Fine. Now, we'd like to begin by talking about your childhood. Let's start by having you tell us, if you will, please, about your parents, their backgrounds, please.
Both of my parents are of East European origin, and both of their families came to the States in 1882. My father came at the age of 6 months. My mother's parents came with several children, but she was not born until 1890. Her parents settled in Harrisburg, and that's where she lived for most of her life, and that's where all of her children were born and where we grew up. My father's family lived partly in the anthracite region of northeastern Pennsylvania, where my grandfather for a while was in the clothes manufacturing business, but most of the time they lived in Philadelphia. My father studied law and moved to Harrisburg to practice law in what he thought would be a developing town with new opportunities. And it was while he was in Harrisburg in his early years there that he met my mother. And they were married in 1912.
That's it. Fill that in for me.
Let's talk about your home life in Harrisburg.
My parents belonged to an Orthodox synagogue. We had a kosher home, but they were not Shomrei Shabbat. As children, we grew up in a Jewish family, in a Jewish environment, although we did not live among Jews.
There were 5 children in the family?
Yes, and I was the youngest. We were close-knit, and our closest friendships were within this circle of siblings. Also, for some reason, which I never understood, my parents chose to live in the east side of the city, which is not where the major Jewish centers of population or the Jewish institutions were located. So we had very few Jewish classmates in the public schools and very few Jewish friends in day-to-day life.
Any sense of being different because you were a member of such a small group of Jews? Was there any sort of anti-Semitism that you recall?
I don't recall any among friends, among schoolmates. Mm-hmm. I have some recollections about worrying about the kashrut of foods that friends would give me, and usually, partly for reasons of kashrut and also for reasons of thrift, I guess, throughout high school, I would always carry lunch to school in a bag. There wasn't enough time to go home for lunch, although we did go home, I guess, from junior high school. We were different in that, well, I really didn't have any strong friends at school, but that may be because of the strong intra-family ties rather than because of differences in religion.
Might want to talk a bit at this point about Jewish education as a young boy.
I attended the Talmud Torah, the supplementary Hebrew school, starting at the kindergarten level and continuing on until we finished 12th grade, and I think I got a pretty good education. And all my brothers and sisters also went through that same afternoon Hebrew school, 4 afternoons a week, and Sundays, and we would have some summer school also. So we had a good deal of exposure and a good deal of real learning.
I know that music is very important in your life now. Did it begin during these early times?
Yes, I grew up in a house that always had music. My mother had been a piano teacher as a younger woman, and probably she gave that up when her own children were born. The older of my two sisters became a piano teacher and started giving piano lessons from her later days in high school. I started to learn to play the piano at home and then learned my own instrument, a violin, when I was in the third grade. And I stayed with the violin. I played in the grade school orchestra and then junior high school orchestra, the senior high school orchestra. I went to college and I played in the college orchestra. And then when I was in graduate school, I learned the joys of playing chamber music. And that's what I have kept up with up to this present time, of playing with a string quartet and other chamber groups.
We will talk about that a little later, because that is a continuing interest in your life. Let's go back to siblings and family before we move on. Are most of them still in this area?
Of my 4 siblings, 2, the younger of the brothers and the younger of the sisters, still live in Harrisburg. The other 2 live in Bound Brook, New Jersey. The older of my sisters married somebody from that part of New Jersey who moved back there after he finished law school to establish a law practice. And the older of my brothers, who became a lawyer, was invited to join my brother-in-law in law practice in that part of New Jersey when my brother came out of the army at the end of World War II. All of my siblings and I attended the same schools, the same elementary school, the same junior high, the same senior high school, and the same college, Dickinson College. We all commuted every day in carpools to the 18-mile distance each way from Harrisburg to Carlisle, where the college was located.
Is some of your family still in Harrisburg?
Yes, one brother and one sister are still living there.
And your mother?
My mother and father moved from Harrisburg to central New Jersey, where my other brother and sister live, in 1948. My father is no longer living, but my mother is still there. She will be 98 years old next month.
You grew up at a difficult time in our history, those Depression years, and I wonder if that in some way influenced you as far as you can tell.
Our family was financially insecure, and my wife chides me about my depression habits of always eating everything that's put on a plate. We didn't spend much things for what we considered unessential things, social things, dancing or going to sporting events for which we would have to pay for tickets. We did have music lessons, all of us. And we all went to college. That was a high priority item with my parents, and we were all encouraged to go. And many of us helped to finance our own college education, and we helped each other. I myself had several jobs through the 4 years at college. I worked as a clerk in a college bookstore and also worked as a secretary for a history professor at the college.
It would be interesting to hear how in this family of lawyers you decided that chemistry was your particular bent. Can you talk with us about that?
There are lots of lawyers in my family, and it was taken for granted by my family as well as by me that I would become a lawyer also. We never had any much of a scientific acculturation as kids. I never had a chemistry set, and we didn't gobble up science books as my own son later did. In high school, I put off taking the one required science course until my 12th year in high school, and I took a chemistry course, and I was fascinated. There was an excellent teacher. He was very inspiring, and that sounded like an interesting subject for me. And also, I think I was looking for some sort of salaried occupation that would provide a more stable financial base than the self-employed professions which my father had gone into.
You graduated from high school in what year?
1937. I attended my 50th high school reunion last fall.
And then
college in 1941. We all worked, all my siblings and I worked hard at college and generally achieved fairly well. I was first in my class at junior high and at high school and at college.
Were there people at Dickinson who made a particular impression on you? This is when you began to study chemistry seriously.
Yes, but not the chemists. I don't think the chemists were that great. But I got a good sound education. They were very good teachers, and I certainly did learn the fundamentals. I later learned when I went to graduate school that what was lacking was an exposure to modern chemistry, and that I had to learn in graduate school. Some of my classmates at graduate school had learned it as undergraduates.
You graduated from college in 1941, another difficult year. Tell us about your preparation for graduate school and what happened next.
I never knew about graduate school when I was a freshman. I learned later that that's what people did if they were really interested in the subject matter, and so I decided to apply for admission and for an appointment as a teaching assistant or as a teaching fellow. And in my senior year at college, I submitted 10 applications, and I was turned down by all 10. One of them, Columbia University, did agree to put me on the waiting list. And I learned late in the spring, I think it was in May, my senior year at college, that a vacancy did develop, and they would take me and give me a teaching assistantship that would allow me to support myself in New York as a graduate student. So that summer, I spent a good deal of the summer reviewing my undergraduate work in preparation for the placement examinations that all new students would have to take, and I did well in them, and I continued to do well in coursework. My graduate study was interrupted, and I spent 2 years on the Manhattan Project in New York. The particular division that I was in, I was concerned with the chemistry of the diffusion process for separating uranium isotopes, and I tried for a while to keep at my research problem at nights and weekends, but I really didn't accomplish much, and so I really didn't put on the steam to finishing my research for the dissertation until I came back to graduate school full-time in 1946.
You were a young graduate student rubbing elbows with some very distinguished scientific giants, I would assume, in the Manhattan Project. Could you talk about people in that group?
The head of the New York division was Harold Urey, Nobel laureate chemist, who had also been chairman of the chemistry department at Columbia when I entered graduate school. There were others who achieved distinction later. Willard Libby was one who later became a Nobel laureate for the work he was to do after the war in developing the radioactive carbon dating method. I had some other very good people I worked with. There was a Simon Freed, there was a Martin Kilpatrick, there was a Clyde Hutchinson, none of them in the Nobel laureate stature, but all very sound scientists. And we did interesting work. When I returned to Columbia full-time in 1946, I returned as an instructor, and I had my own classes to teach, not just laboratory sections. And I taught for 2 years general chemistry and analytical chemistry. In 1946, I started discussions with a group of scientists in New York City who were organizing what was to be a department of biophysics at the Weizmann Institute in Rehovot. And I was part of that planning group, and we spent a good deal of time planning for the structure of that department, for the construction of laboratories, the ordering of equipment that would be needed. The leading person in that group was a biophysical chemist at Brooklyn Polytechnic named Kurt Stern. He died in 1947 or 1948, and so most of the people who had been recruited by him be part of his team decided not to go at that time, and that was true of me. I also withdrew from that plan and then decided to do postdoctoral work, and I made a last-minute application for a national fellowship, which I was fortunate to win.
During this time that you were getting ready to make adjustments in your professional life, you also had some very important things happening in your personal life.
Yes, it was in 1945, around, I remember, it was just the time of Franklin D. Roosevelt's death that I had my first date with the person who was to become my wife about a year and a half later. She was a New Yorker, born to an Israeli family, who left Palestine during World War I. Her father ran away to avoid the draft in the Turkish army. And although he had been a Sabra with deep roots in Palestine, being a sixth generation Jerusalemite, he stayed in the States until after World War II. He returned. When I went to Israel for my first trip in 1962, it was my wife's first trip also to Israel or Palestine.
Tell us about your meeting with her.
We met at the Jewish Theological Seminary cafeteria. The seminary is located just a few blocks away from Columbia University, and I often ate there. And I was anxious to meet somebody with whom I would have a good deal of compatibility in terms of background, outlook on life, and general interests, and I asked one of the rabbinical students at the seminary, whom I had met, to introduce me to somebody who would fulfill these objectives, and he did, and so that turned out to be a very successful shidduch.
You married in New York then, and your wife's name?
Is Shoshana Gabriel. That was her maiden name.
And you and she then have this decision to make about where you would go.
Well, we made the decision to go
to
Israel, and
yes,
then we made the decision to back out of that.
Yes.
And then the fellowship that I got was designed to take me to the University of Chicago. So we went to the University of Chicago in 1948, about 7 months after I completed my doctoral degree.
You were married in 1946.
Yes. We were married in the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue in New York City, the rabbi of which was married to a cousin of my wife's, David de Sola Poole.
I'd like to pick up on some people that you've mentioned on the tape. Most recently, the rabbi who performed your ceremony, a very distinguished gentleman, and you may want to talk about him a bit.
His wife is a cousin of my wife's father. And they were all Palestinians, the Hershensons. There were four sisters and one brother in that family. And all the women were individual achievers. My brother-in-law called them the Jewish Sung sisters. The wife of Rabbi David de Sola Poole, Tamar, had been national president of Hadassah and had been active in many national and international Jewish organizations. She had a good secular as well as Jewish education. She studied in France. The oldest of the sisters, her name was Nima Adlerblum, was a philosopher. And she kept doing her own things, writing up until her 90s. She was a vigorous woman in physical things, an inveterate swimmer and mountain climber. And until quite late in life, she received some worldwide coverage in her last decade of life by her refusal to evacuate her room in the King David Hotel when President Nixon was visiting Jerusalem. So there was general newspaper coverage of her forcible eviction from the King David.
This is a feisty family you're describing here.
Or maybe, I forget it. Maybe it turned out that President Nixon said, okay, let her stay. I don't remember the outcome, but I know she raised objections. Another sister was the first woman Hillel director in this country. Her name was Esther. I can't think of her last name right now, but she became the Hillel director at Texas A&M after her husband, who was a professor of agronomy, died at that institution. The youngest sister, Tehillah Lichtenstein, married a Reformed rabbi who developed his own religious movement, namely Jewish Science. And when he died at a fairly early age, she took over without any formal training for the rabbinate. She became the leader of the Jewish Science movement.
These are aunts of Shoshana.
They're cousins.
Cousins.
Yes.
All right.
And the one brother settled in Pittsburgh. When we moved to Pittsburgh, that was our whole Pittsburgh family. We had never met them before. Mm. He and his wife were living here.
Interesting people.
Yes.
Other interesting people. You mentioned earlier on that you had some contact with Edward Teller. He was one of the people that you...
He had been a substitute teacher of mine. He came to teach when... Harold Urey was off doing war work. Mm. He was a very good teacher. Another substitute teacher was Maria Mayer, who was later to get a Nobel Prize. She substituted for her husband, Joseph Mayer, when he was off doing war work. And it's interesting, and feminists, I think, can take a special interest in this story. Universities used to have anti-nepotism rules, and when her husband taught at Johns Hopkins University, she was not allowed to have a faculty appointment, a regular one, so she had some auxiliary appointment as a lecturer, but not as a regular professor. When they came to New York, there were similar rules at Columbia. Her husband had a professorship, and she taught at Sarah Lawrence College, one of the small girls' colleges in the neighborhood, and did some part-time teaching at Columbia. They went to Chicago then. Her husband had a professorship, and she was not allowed to have a faculty appointment, so she just did her own research in her own office. And then they both left Chicago, and they went to the University of California at La Jolla, and they both got professorships, and she got a Nobel Prize. Her husband did not.
That is a good story.
Can I interrupt? I must ask you, is there any little story you can add about Edward Teller? I've read all about him, and I think everybody would be interested.
I don't have any stories. He was a good, spontaneous lecturer. He was so full of his subject, and he was very clear in classroom presentations. I didn't get to know him personally, but I appreciated him very much as a teacher.
Yuri, your impressions of him as teacher, as person?
Well, our class was glad when Yuri was absent, because then we would get Teller. Teller was a better teacher.
Yes.
But Yuri was a fine person. He was very much preoccupied with organizing the Manhattan Project. He was one of the national leaders in that movement, even before the Manhattan Project was formally organized. And he was a powerfully gifted chemist, and as I later learned, is true for all Nobel laureates, completely driven, just motivated in a unidirectional fashion to follow a scientific career and spend all the times in science. And he was so busy, I didn't get to know him very well personally. I later got to know his daughter very well in Pittsburgh. because I hired her as associate dean when I became dean at Pittsburgh, and we were colleagues for 15 years. Mm-hmm. Her name is Elizabeth Baranger, B-A-R-A-N-G-E-R.
I'm curious to know, by comparison, what were the size of classes in those days?
In graduate school?
Compared to
Well,
today.
In the first year classes, probably 25 or 30 in a classroom. How many students did they take in per year? Maybe two dozen.
Let's pick up, if we may, the move from Columbia to Chicago. Your work there, your professional life there.
Well, the move itself was interesting. We went partly by ship.
Oh, ship to Chicago?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
We still had not had our first family car. So we went in stages. We took a train to Buffalo, but having a stop on the way at a delightful state park, Letchworth State Park. And then from Buffalo, we took an overnight ship to Detroit. And then from Detroit, another train to Chicago. So we were carrying all our belongings in our hands. I guess we must have sent something on ahead. I don't remember. We had our first apartment in the Kenwood. I forget what it was called. It was north of the, no, it was south of the Midway. And then within a year, we moved to the Hyde Park area, which was a pleasanter neighborhood. Both of those neighborhoods were within walking or bicycling distance of the university, and thus I established, continued a pattern we had at Columbia. I always lived within a block of Columbia and always walked to work in New York, then at Chicago, and at Pittsburgh also walked to work. The important decision to be made in the first few months for me and my professional work was to choose a laboratory with which to be affiliated. And since I brought my own money, since I had a national fellowship sponsored by the Atomic Energy Commission, I could choose to work any place that would take me. So I decided to work in the photosynthesis laboratory of James Franck, a distinguished German-born physicist, Nobel laureate, which was granted in recognition of some of his pioneering work in atomic physics of the teen years of this century.
That's Franck,
F-R-A-N-C-K. Yes. I found the postdoctoral experience very stimulating because there was a variety of problems, and I participated in the design of research projects, and it was an exciting period. Some of the projects who were worked on were very competitive in that other groups were working on similar projects at other universities, and I learned about scientific competition for the first time, trying to get there right and first, and we didn't always win. But I had very good training in that laboratory. Franck was the principal scientist in the laboratory, and another principal scientist was Hans Gaffron, and developed continuing personal relationships that were to follow on after I left Chicago with both of them and their families.
These are very distinguished scientists who left Germany, so these were among the refugee scientists who came
to
Chicago.
Yes, Franck was Jewish, Gaffron was not Jewish, but they both left voluntarily. Franck was revered, and the authorities tried to persuade him to stay, but he resigned his professorship at Göttingen shortly after the Nuremberg laws were enacted to wage battle with these anti-Semitic decrees and to use his influence to try to place his scientific colleagues in positions throughout the world. Gaffron left because he could not stand living in the Nazi regime, and so he voluntarily left also. Since he was not Jewish, he was not compelled to leave.
Was Teller's background also that of one who had come from
Hungary? No, there were about four Hungarian Jewish scientists who all made their mark in the Manhattan Project one way or the other. A remarkable group. There was Teller, and there was Wigner, and there was Weisskopf. Another German was John von Neumann, who was an applied mathematician, who incidentally converted to Catholicism in this country before he died. But there were, all in all, there were many German scientists who populated universities and strengthened universities in the West and in Palestine.
While you were finding your particular area of specialty, your wife was also working in her own direction, I assume.
Yes, she's an artist. She was an art major at college, at Queens College, and shortly after we got married in New York in 1946, she was thinking of finding an employable skill, so she went to the Art Students League to study fashion illustration. And when we got to Chicago, she found employment doing fashion illustration for department stores or for a studio that did work for department stores. And she continued that until our first child was born in the end of 1951. So that's about 3 years after we got to Chicago.
Did you continue your affiliation with the Jewish community in Chicago? What was that like?
Principal affiliation was with the Hillel group at the University of Chicago. We did join a synagogue. It was a con-